welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the program today, Dan Friedel reports on some big summer movies that are creating Academy Awards buzz. We also hear from reporter Phil Dierking. He tells about efforts in Washington, D.C. to protect and even expand a kind of art creation that is illegal in many places. And of course, we close the program, as always, with an American short story. Today, we hear the second and final part of Hearts and Crosses. Writer O. Henry included the story in his collection Hearts of the West, published in 1907. But first, we hear a report on international vaccination rates and what they might mean for the future of the world's children. Here is Anne Ball.
The World Health Organization says almost 1 in 10 babies worldwide received no vaccines in 2016. That means almost 13 million babies missed the first of 3 required injections of a vaccine to protect against the diseases diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. It is called the DTP3 vaccination. An additional 6.6 million infants got that first injection but failed to get the other 2 doses last year. Since 2010, the percentage of children who received their full course of routine immunizations has stalled at 86%, WHO said in a statement on Monday. This falls short of the worldwide immunization coverage target of 90%, the statement noted. It said there were no important changes in any countries or areas during the year. Present immunization levels prevent 2 to 3 million deaths worldwide every year from diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, and measles, WHO said. It called routine vaccinations one of the most successful and cost-effective public health actions that can be carried out. 130 of the 194 WHO member states have reached the 90% level for DPT3 vaccines. Most unvaccinated infants live in countries where there is conflict or high levels of poverty. 8 nations had levels below 50% for DPT3 shots in 2016. They were Central African Republic, Chad, Equatorial Guinea, Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, Syria, and Ukraine. If we are going to raise the bar on worldwide immunization coverage, health services must reach the unreached, said WHO's Jean-Marie Okwobele. Every contact with the health system must be seen as a chance to protect children against disease. The good news is that WHO reported gains in vaccinations against rubella, a virus that can cause severe birth defects in children. but the vaccine must be given to pregnant women before they give birth. Around the world, coverage against rubella increased from 35% in 2010 to 47% in 2016, WHO said. It called the improvement a big step toward reducing the condition that results in hearing loss, heart problems, and blindness. The fight for higher vaccination rates is not just happening in developing nations or those experiencing war. In France, the government passed a measure requiring that by 2018, French parents will have to vaccinate their children against a number of diseases. They include pertussis, measles, mumps, and rubella. France already requires vaccinations against diphtheria, tetanus, and poliomyelitis. Exceptions are made for infants with a few medical conditions. The French law is a reaction to the movement against vaccinations in developed countries. In the United States, Britain, and France, the measles vaccination rate has fallen below the 95% level. That is the level that stops the spread of the disease. Children are still dying of measles, French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe told Parliament. He called that not admissible in the homeland of Louis Pasteur, the scientist who discovered vaccines. I'm Anne Ball.
In past years, most big summer films have been action movies. Stars like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone became known for appearing in summer movies. In recent years, movies featuring Batman, Spider-Man, Superman, The Incredible Hulk, Thor, the X-Men, and other comic book characters dominated the theaters. Such summer blockbusters are not usually considered as serious possibilities for big awards like Oscars and Golden Globes. Studios usually release films they think could win such awards later in the year. The Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences is the organization behind the Oscars, or Academy Awards. Critics have argued that the organization often ignores movies that are hugely popular with the public. But this year, some big summer releases are getting a lot of awards buzz. Among them is a July movie called Dunkirk. Christopher Nolan directed the film, which is based on an event that happened during World War II. A New York Times critic recently called the film a tour de force and brilliant. The story takes place in 1940. Hundreds of thousands of Allied soldiers were battling with Germany near the French city of Dunkirk. The Allied soldiers were under especially great risk of being killed or captured. But an evacuation effort took place over a few days in late May and early June. Many small civilian boats crossed the English Channel to help more than 300,000 soldiers escape danger. Emma Thomas is the producer of Dunkirk. She said she is not worried about awards. She just wants to make movies that people like. July is a good time for movies because many people take time off from work and have time to go to the theater. This film we primarily thought of as an entertainment, she said. For us, we make films for audiences. My feeling is always, if your film works and people engage with it, anything that comes later is a huge bonus. Audiences, Thomas said, think differently about movies that come out later in the year. You're almost limiting it, in a way, and we don't want to limit the film. Another summer film that may make Oscars news is Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman has sold a lot of tickets since it came out in June. Over $380 million worth. But it has received great critical praise as well. Both director Patty Jenkins and actress Gal Gadot could be considered for awards early next year. A recently released summer movie receiving award buzz is The Big Sick. It tells the real-life story of a Muslim-American comedian who falls in love with a young woman right before she gets seriously sick. Doctors place the woman into a coma while they treat her. The film Detroit is also under discussion as a possible award nominee. The movie will open in August. It tells about 5 days of riots in the city of Detroit, Michigan, 50 years ago, during the summer of 1967. Catherine Bigelow directed Detroit. She also directed The Hurt Locker, which won Best Picture in 2010. It was also a summer movie. Bigelow said, "Awards are not why we make these films. Whatever happens along any other lines, I have no idea." I'm Dan Friedell.
Washington, D.C. has a complex relationship with graffiti and street art. Local street artist Gobi knows this well. Not long ago, a police officer caught him spraying colorful paint on the side of a building. Gobi did not get permission to put his design on the building. What he was doing then was illegal. The police officer arrested Gobi. Then, he asked Gobi for his business card. The officer said he was interested in hiring him for a street art project in the future. America's capital city is trying hard to control its illegal graffiti problem. At the same time, city officials recognize the value and importance of street art. There is a high demand for more artists to make street art legally, but the city offers few chances for young DC street artists to develop their skills without breaking the law. Some local programs, however, are trying to change that. Graffiti and street art are forms of art created on walls or public surfaces. This art is often considered illegal because it is done without the permission of the building owners. These art forms have existed since the times of ancient Greece. but the more modern style began forming in the 1960s in the cities of New York and Philadelphia. Graffiti often appears as words, usually the names of the artist or their art crew. Graffiti artists write the words in creative ways and with colorful spray paint. Street art is more based on images. Artists try to communicate a message through these images. Large pieces of street art are also called murals. Graffiti and street art can be controversial. They are sometimes used to mark gang territory or damage someone's property. Washington has tried to increase its fines for illegal graffiti, yet it is also encouraging the creation of public art and murals. Corey Stowers is a D.C.-based graffiti and street artist. He is president of the D.C. graffiti crew Double Down Kings, or 2DK. He is also the art director for Art Block D.C., a local street art organization. With Art Block D.C., Stowers is trying to create a bridge between the street art community and the D.C. public. He helps get permission from building owners to organize large mural projects around the city. The projects give local street artists the chance to create their art in public without fear of breaking the law. They also give younger artists a chance to develop their skills. These projects are important, Stowers says. DC is making it more and more difficult for graffiti street artists to get practice. Construction projects and increased security have taken away important practice spaces throughout the city. Practice is extremely important, Stowers explains. Many artists who paint popular murals in communities today got their start by painting graffiti.
There's always this conversation that you have to have with folks and explaining to them that the young person that wrote a signature on their wall 10 years from now may be the person that they're asking to come and paint a mural. Without one, you don't get the other.
Street artists with Art Block DC ask community members for their opinions on the murals. They want to create pieces that are meaningful for local residents. Stowers says interacting with the local community helps to humanize graffiti and street artists.
I think as communities start to recognize the value of public murals and they start to understand who actually can paint them, the idea of cultivating graffiti artists will become, I think, a little bit more popular.
In 2008, the city government created the program Murals DC. The program hires artists to paint legal murals around the city. Nancy Lyons is Murals DC's art director. She says the program has two goals. One is to try to prevent illegal graffiti. The other is to beautify the city. Program officials believe that if murals already cover city walls, graffiti artists will not paint over them illegally. And Neocon Udofia is a D.C.-based artist. He often paints for Murals D.C. and is known for his large works of art around the city. He says the logic of the program is correct. Unofficial rules in the street artist and graffiti community say that the more complex the work of art, the more priority it has on a wall. Large murals, then, often take priority over simpler graffiti art. They are usually not vandalized or damaged.
Going over a well-done, beautiful mural, it goes outside of graffiti. At that point, it's just that you hate either the artist or you hate the work that has been created.
Udofia and his art director, Mia Duval, agree that communicating with the local residents is very important.
I think anything you do in a public space, you have to consider the community. We have to consider who is seeing this, how it's going to affect them, and what's important to them. So every piece we do, we really do our best to make sure that we are being sensitive and thoughtful about who has to see this every day and how they're going to embrace this.
Udofia recently finished a major Murals DC project. It covers one of the walls of Ben's Chili Bowl, a historic DC restaurant. The bright and colorful mural features 16 well-known African Americans, including Barack and Michelle Obama, Harriet Tubman, Muhammad Ali, and Dave Chappelle. The work was introduced to the public in a ceremony on June 21st. Actor and comedian Dave Chappelle attended the ceremony. He told VOA that public art is an important part of a city's culture.
Public art is like right to the heart of a culture of a city, who they love, who they represent, what's the neighborhood about.
I'm Phil Dierking.
Hearts and Crosses. One day, a man named Bartholomew, not an important man, stopped at the Nopalito Ranch House. It was noon, and he was hungry. He sat down at the dinner table. While he was eating, he talked. "Mrs. Yeager," he said, "I saw a man on the Seco Ranch with your name, Webb Yeager. He was foreman there. He was a tall, yellow-haired man. Not a talker. Someone of your family?"
"A husband," said Santa. "That is fine for the Seco Ranch. Mr. Yeager is the best foreman in the West."
Everything at the Nopalito Ranch had been going well. For several years, they'd been working at the Nopalito with a different kind of cattle. These cattle had been brought from England, and they were better than the usual Texas cattle. They had been successful at the Nopalito Ranch, and men on the other ranches were interested in them. As a result, one day a cowboy arrived at the Nopalito Ranch and gave the queen this letter.
"Mrs. Yeager, the Nopalito Ranch. I've been told by the owners of the Seco Ranch to buy 100 of your English cattle. If you can sell these to the Seco, send them to us in care of the man who brings this letter. We will then send you the money. Webb Yeager, foreman, Seco Ranch."
Business is business to a queen as it is to others. That night, the 100 cattle were moved near the ranch house, ready for an early start the next morning. When the night came and the house was quiet, did Santa Yeager cry alone? Did she hold that letter near to her heart? Did she speak the name that she had been too proud to speak for many weeks? Or did she place the letter with other business letters in her office? Ask if you will, but there is no answer. What a queen does is something we cannot always know. But this you shall be told. In the middle of the night, Santa went quietly out of the ranch house. She was dressed in something dark. She stopped for a moment under a tree. There was moonlight, and a bird was singing. There was a smell of flowers. Santa turned her face toward the southeast and threw three kisses in that direction. But there was no one to see her. Then she hurried quietly to a small building. What she did there, we can only guess. But there was the red light of a fire and noise as if Cupid might be making his arrows. Later, she came out with some strange iron tool in one hand. In the other hand, she carried something that held a small fire. She hurried in the moonlight to the place where the English cattle had been gathered. Most of the English cattle were a dark red, but among those 100, there was one as white as milk. And now Santa caught that white animal as cowboys catch cattle. And she tried once and failed. Then she tried again, and the animal fell heavily. Santa ran to it, but the animal jumped up. Again she tried, and this time she was successful. The animal fell to earth again. Before it could rise, Santa had tied its feet together. Then she ran to the fire she had carried here. From it, she took that strange iron tool. It was white hot. There was a loud cry from the animal as the white hot iron burned its skin. But no one seemed to hear. All the ranch were quiet. And in the deep night quiet, Santa ran back to the ranch house and there fell onto a bed. She let the tears from her eyes, as if queens had hearts like the hearts of ranchmen's wives, and as if a queen's husband might become a king, if he would ride back again. In the morning, the young man who had brought the letter started toward the Saco Ranch. He had cowboys with him to help him with the English cattle. It was 90 miles, 6 days' journey. The animals arrived at Saco Ranch one evening as the daylight was ending. They were received and counted by the foreman of the ranch. The next morning at 8, a horseman came riding to the Nopalito ranch house. He got down painfully from the horse and walked to the house. His horse took a great breath and let his head hang and closed his eyes. Bud did not feel sorry for Belshazzar, the horse. Today, he lives happily at Nopalito, where he is given the best care and the best food. No other horse there has ever carried a man for such a ride. The horseman entered the house. Two arms fell around his neck, and someone cried out in the voice of a woman and queen together,
"Webb! Oh, Webb!"
"I was wrong," said Webb Yeager. "I was a..." And he named a small animal with a bad smell, an animal no one likes.
"Quiet," said Santa. "Did you see it?"
"I saw it," said Webb. What were they speaking of? Perhaps you can guess if you have read the story carefully.
"Be the cattle queen," said Webb. "Forget what I did if you can. I was wrong as..."
"Quiet,"
said Santa again, putting her fingers upon his mouth.
"There's no queen here. Do you know who I am? I am Santa Yeager, First Lady of the Bedroom." "Come here."
She led him into a room. There stood a low baby's bed. And in the bed was a baby, a beautiful laughing baby, talking in words that no one could understand.
"There's no queen on this ranch," said Santa again. "Look at the king. He has eyes like yours, Webb. Get down on your knees and look at the king."
There was a sound of steps outside, and Bud Turner was there at the door. He was asking the same question he had asked almost a year ago. "Good morning. Shall I drive those cattle to Barber's, or..." He saw Webb and stopped with his mouth open. Cried the king, waving his arms.
"You hear what he says, Bud," said Webb Yeager. "We do what the king commands."
And that is all, except for one thing. When old man Quinn, owner of the Saco Ranch, went to look at his new English cattle, he asked his new foreman, "What's the Nopalito Ranch's mark?"
"X over Y," said Wilson.
"I thought so," said Quinn.
"But look at that white animal there. She has another mark, a heart with a cross inside. Whose mark is that?"
That was the final part of Hearts and Crosses, an American short story by O. Henry. That's it for today's show, but tune in same time tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.